Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. Fetchmail is first. Fetchmail is a, as described in its package description, Fetchmail is a mail retrieval and forwarding utility. It fetches mail from a POP, IMAP, or ETRN capable, I literally don't know what ETRN stands for, capable remote mail server and forwards it to your local, that is your client, the computer in front of you, machine's delivery system. Or rather, I shouldn't say the computer in front of you, I should say the computer upon which Fetchmail has run. You can then handle the retrieved mail using a normal mail user agent. A mail user agent, or MUA, MUA, is like MUT, or Pine, or Elm, or Alpine. The Fetchmail utility can be run in a daemon mode to repeatedly poll one or more systems at a specified interval. Fetchmail is probably not secure. That's the description from the package. So that's Fetchmail. If you go to fetchmail.info, you can get a lot more information about Fetchmail. I'm really quite impressed by the website. It does indeed have a lot of information about kind of what it does, why it exists, who wrote it, how the philosophy of kind of maintenance has changed. It's good. It's a lot of good information, and you can, I don't know how long this has been true, but you can definitely use SSL, TLS with Fetchmail, at least some versions of Fetchmail. You'd have to make sure that you're running a version of Fetchmail that supports all of this, but it's absolutely possible to do that. So the little note about Fetchmail probably not being secure, I mean, you can kind of never go wrong with a statement of, hey, this is probably not secure because, you know, like, nobody knows, right? It's probably safer to say something's not secure. But I think my impression is that probably since that little note in the package got written, since then my impression, just kind of from the website today, of today, is that maybe there's been quite a lot of work done with Fetchmail. That's kind of my impression. And in the FAQ, in fact, the maintainers say that, where was this part? The maintainer, there was a note, a specific note about kind of like the general philosophy of, yep, here it is. So the question was, what is Fetchmail and why would I bother? And in that question, it says, well, actually, this whole answer is quite good, but it says, Fetchmail is not a toy or a coder's learning exercise, but an industrial strength tool capable of transparently handling every retrieval demand, from those of a simple single user ISP connection to a mail retrieval and rerouting for an entire client domain, not just a client host, a client domain. Fetchmail is easy to configure, unobtrusively in operation, powerful, or rather unobtrusive in operation, powerful, feature-rich, and well-documented. So then it continues to say, Fetchmail is open source software. The openness of the sources enable you to review and customize the code and contribute your changes. A former Fetchmail maintainer once claimed that open source software was the strongest quality assurance, but the current maintainers do not believe that open source alone is a criterion for quality. The remotely exploitable POP3 vulnerability, that's CVE-2005-2335, lingered undiscovered in Fetchmail's code for years, which is a hint that open source code does not audit itself. That's a really important statement. It impresses me a lot that they say that so plainly here. It's really, really vital for that to be said, I think. You know, and I don't know how the thing got started about, like, oh, it's open source, it's more secure. Linux, it's more secure. I don't know, like, sort of how that sort of that gross generalization became so ubiquitous. And it's one of those things that, you know, deep down you do want it to be true. If you're an open source user, if you're a Linux user, that sounds great. It sounds like a feature. And we have, you know, it's hard to find features in the modern computing world that you can kind of promote and lay claim to, because everybody's got the same thing at this point, pretty much. Everyone's copying everyone else. So it's really hard to kind of find a differentiator. But just the blanket statement that open source is more secure is just not correct. I mean, that's just not, it has the opportunity to be more secure because the source code is right there, but someone has to look at the code. And as I keep saying on this podcast, and I will continue to say it, if nobody's looking at the code, it is functionally not open source. I mean, it is open source, but I mean, it's doing nobody any good if nobody ever looks at the code. And there's a lot of software running on my computer right now that I don't look at the code to. So, I mean, does it really matter that it's open source? I mean, it does, but it also, you know, in terms of like whether I should trust that or not, well, not if I haven't looked at the code. I mean, I can believe people who have looked at the code, but I have to also believe that they have looked at the code and that they've looked at it carefully and so on. So it's difficult. So what does FetchMail do then? Like, what actually does it do? Well, it's an application that has a bunch of protocols programmed into it. It sort of, if you think of it, you know, it speaks the language of a lot of different mail protocols, and it talks to those protocols so that you don't have to. So you can look at the protocol specifications, certainly of POP3 and IMAP, by just looking up the RFC. They give you a really good description of exactly how the protocol works. And so just taking POP3 as a simple example, the basic operation of, and this is RFC 1939, and I mean, you can literally just look up RFC 1939 and you'll get a bunch of results to various sites that catalog RFCs. RFCs are technical papers describing a technology, and it's describing the technology, and RFC is request for comment. And so these are designed as descriptions of technology, and then people collaborate on the design, and eventually it becomes locked into place, and then the protocol gets implemented. So this one was created ages ago, back in 1996, it looks like. That's what it looks like to me. Maybe that's true. And it is updated by 1957, 2449, 8314, and another one. So yeah, so 8314, but also it looks like 8997. Boy, this is a lot of information. So I'm going to go back to 8314, I think, because that's probably the one that I want, really. Yes, I think so. Oh no, because this is pretty specific to a lot more than just POP3. All right, I'm going back to 1939 then. So 1939, created in 1996. Difficult to keep those numbers sort of separate. It's 1939 does not refer to a year. That is just the number of the RFC. 1996 refers to a year in which this 1939 RFC was authored, apparently. So here we go. It says, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I just want to kind of give you an idea of. So initially, the server host starts the POP3 service by listening on TCP port 110. Now that would be different, of course, if you're going to interact over SSL and stuff. When a client host wishes to make use of the service, it establishes a TCP connection with the server host. When the connection is established, the POP3 server sends a greeting. The client and POP3 server exchange commands and responses until the connection is closed or aborted. Commands in POP3 consist of case insensitive keywords, possibly followed by one or more arguments. And all of those commands, they're terminated by a new line character, all of those commands are listed in this RFC. If you keep scrolling down, it gives you, like, really, like a menu, essentially, of what you could possibly say to a POP3 server and expect a valid response. And there are things like list all of the messages, delete a message, quit, you know, abort the connection, username, password, and so on. So it's all listed there for you. It also, in section 9, gives you a command, a minimal POP3 interaction, which would look like a user and then the name, and then the password string, and that would get you out of the authorization mode, or authorization state, as they call it. There's also the transaction state, which you could do a list, a certain message, a retrieve the message, now delete the message from the server, and so on. So it's a terminal connection. It's a command line. It's a command prompt where you give a command and maybe an argument, and the server does a thing and responds and tells you how that thing went. So it's a normal kind of interaction that you'd expect, but certainly most of us don't want to have to log in to a POP3 server manually and issue those commands every time we want to check mail. So fetch mail can do all of that for you, as long as you configure fetch mail with all your credentials. So it knows what to say to that POP3 connection. You don't have to use it for POP3, as the package description says. You can also use it for IMAP, or what was the other one? ETRN, which, again, don't know what that is. But yeah, you can get fetch mail to do all of that work for you. You can run fetch mail as a daemon so that it does that for you on a regular basis. You don't even have to think about it. Of course, in order for fetch mail to know what you want it to do, you need to do a configuration. And that is actually not all that hard. It can be like a single line, poll, P-O-L-L, meaning it's going to poll a server. So poll, P-O-L-L, pop.example.com. So in other words, that would be the domain name that resolves to some server running a mail server. You can't assume that, like, any old web server has pop dot, you know, whatever, that serves its mail. And in fact, it may be running an email server, but it might not put it on pop dot its domain name. It could be mail.example.com. It could be mypopserver.example.com. It's just down to whatever the person who configured the DNS records decided this thing would be called. Okay, so poll pop.example.com, protocol POP3, that's important, and then username, quote, Klaatu, close quote, password, quote, my password, 123, close quote. That's it. That's the command. So as you can kind of tell here, there's some stuff in here that's kind of the universal abstraction of some very specific, in this case, POP3 commands. There's the username subcommand here, or argument here. Username, well, that's not a POP command, but we know that maps to user, U-S-E-R, and then the username. Password, that's not a POP command, but that maps to pass, P-A-S-S, along with the password. So you're giving fetch mail sort of the generic arguments that most mail servers are going to require. Fetch mail figures out how to translate that. So POP3 might ask for user and pass, while IMAP might ask for, I don't know, something else. I'd have to look it up. Username and password, or uname and passwd. Who knows? Like, whatever the command over there is, it'll get translated by fetch mail so that it's a valid command. It can get fancier than that. There's a lot of new, there are some new options that just weren't supported previously, but as a fetch mail 6.3.5, some new features. I mean, I'm sure new features get added a lot of times, but specifically in the manual online, 6.3.5 is called out as something that has some maybe more modern options or modern feeling options, like just the support for, like, user at domain formatting rather than than specifying things separately. So lots of different ways to possibly do this. There are plugins that you can use so that you can maybe use different methods of getting the mail. Like the protocol stays the same, but you might be able to tunnel through, for instance, SSH or something like that. And certainly SSL is available nowadays. So you'd have to read the manual page for the details, depending on what you're trying to do. But that is what fetch mail does. Okay, on to the next one briefly, getmail. Getmail was written as a replacement for fetchmail, and it's in a state, I would say, of confusion currently. So the package installed on Slackware is based on Python 3.9, but the website for the getmail project says pretty flatly that getmail doesn't support Python 3, that it was written in 2 whatever, Python 2, and has not been updated for 3, and that he intends to update it to Python 3, but has not gotten around to doing that yet. It also says on the website that someone else has updated it to version 3 in what the maintainer calls a hostile fork, and says that that's unrelated to getmail, I guess 5, like get, so the Python 3 version is getmail 6, and so the previous one, I guess, would be getmail 5, I guess, and so they're apparently unrelated, and the original getmail author calls getmail 6 a hostile fork, having been upgraded from 2 to 3 sort of without his involvement. He says that he's reached out to the person who did the conversion or the update, and they're not working together. So, and apparently he would like this getmail 6 to stop using the getmail name altogether, but the person declines to not use that name. So I don't know. Point is, I don't know what's going on there, but the point is that getmail is a little bit it's in a state of confusion, really. I mean, I don't know. I'm reading it on this website. I don't have either side of the story. I've just got this sort of the state of the code is that the old version uses Python 2, which I'm not interested in running, and the new version is using Python 3, which I am interested in running, but is apparently not up to the standards of the original code maintainer. So that kind of casts them, to my mind, both in doubt. I would probably just want to eventually look at the code for getmail 6 and see if I can make any sense of it and get kind of any kind of assurance that it is doing what it claims to be doing. But in order to even do that, I'd have to look at what it claims to be doing. And all I know is that it claims to have been written as a replacement for fetchmail. Well, I've just done a pretty thorough overview of what fetchmail can do, and it can do a lot these days. It's been kind of updated and brought up to modern standards in many ways. And so I think were I going to use a mail retrieval system outside of what I'm already using, I would probably just go with fetchmail. And that's kind of I think that's all I have to say about getmail. I'm sure that it was very, very useful when fetchmail was just kind of languishing in kind of this weird kind of like reality, alternate reality where, you know, POP3 didn't require SSL and mail systems were still just local computers with mail spools. I'm sure getmail was very useful at that point. But today, I'm not going to run a mail program that can't run on Python 3. Python 2 is well and truly end of life. It is just silly to go back and run something on Python 2 for me. I mean, again, it doesn't really matter. Honestly, I'm behind a firewall. This is largely like it's purely academic. It's just, but like deep down, I just don't want to run something on Python 2. And in fact, when I find little utilities that I do want to run and they are only on Python 2, it's not unheard of for me to just run them through Python 2 to 3 and do whatever cleanup is required to get it from 2 to 3 and just run the thing a local fork of a thing on Python 3. I've done it on a couple of different applications, mostly at work, actually, strangely. It's not usually for stuff that I actually need in real life, but stuff that I needed at work, just updated it to 3 and ran the 3 version. It just seems weird to go that far back to Python 2 and run something that just hasn't gotten around to updating. Because Python 2 is end of life. I mean, if it was just that it just hadn't updated, I might think, okay, well, who needs it? But I mean, Python 2 is over. Like, it's gone. It's history. So I just don't feel super comfortable running, I don't know, a mail retrieval that uses Python 2. So if anything, I think I would lean toward Gitmail 6, but knowing that it's maybe a little bit unsanctioned and I'd have to look at the code to kind of figure out what the heck is going on, I think I'll just stick with Fetchmail. But I mean, in real life, obviously I'm not using either. I'm just using Kmail, and it does all the stuff that I need it to do. And knowing that, I think it's time for some coffee. Let's go get some coffee. We'll come back and we'll talk about GNU-PG. And I'm back. Got coffee. I hope you have coffee. I am drinking the Unite or Traverse. Honestly, it's both of those things. The store I go to for my coffee rarely has full bins of coffee, because I mean, I'm in New Zealand. Coffee is pretty popular here, but it isn't. People don't drink. Well, does anybody really drink it like I drink it? But certainly not in New Zealand. So in New Zealand, you know, you got a lot of tea. There's a big tea culture. So coffee is good maybe for the mornings, but that's really all people expect you to have coffee for. So people don't go to stores and get like a kilogram of coffee beans. I go to stores for a kilogram of coffee beans. So they never have enough. So I end up just doing a custom blend that's what I'll call it, of whatever beans they happen to have enough of, or rather, you know, from each container, I will just keep filling my own container with beans until it is full. So that's kind of how I have to do it, which I actually might have to change because the new owner of the store actually tracks how much of each kind of a thing she sells. So I might have to put it in smaller containers now. That's neither here nor there for you, actually, unless you're going to go shopping with me, in which case you should be aware of these changes. But assuming you're not, let's talk about GNU-PG and GNU-PG2. So there are two entries for this one. It's GNU-PG, that's the package, and that one supports, I think, what is it, GNU-PG 1.4 or something like that, up to 1.4 or 1.6 or some even number. And then there's GNU-PG2, which I guess must support GNU-PG 2.4 probably. So I'm going to talk about them as if though they were the same. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, GNU-PG is only included really for backwards compatibility, backwards support. So I don't think that, I think generally they are very similar, but I guess they must be different enough that they had to, you know, reversion things. But GNU-PG2 is the sort of the current one, and I'm going to talk about it. Just GNU-PG, GNU-PG2, same thing for the purpose of this discussion. Let's talk about GNU-PG. So GNU-PG stands for GNU Privacy Guard, and the abbreviation for that, in fact, the command that you use on Slackware is GPG, specifically GPG2. GPG is the sort of, I guess, the inverse of the technology it's based on, which is PGP, which stands for Pretty Good Privacy. That's actually what it stands for, Pretty Good Privacy. It was famously the subject of litigation. Don't quote me on any of this because I didn't look it up. I'm going off of memory and I'm not a lawyer, but I believe it was litigation against the U.S. federal government, I believe, was persecuting the author of PGP because it was just too darn good. Like, really, like, I'm not making this up. They were afraid that this person had created a cryptography that could be abused by foreign powers. Those were the days. So it was a big deal. It was a really big computer sort of case because, I mean, think of it. If the U.S. federal government had ruled that software developers were essentially responsible for how good their software was. I mean, it's just so bizarre. Again, don't quote me, like, look up the details if you want to know more, because I'm going off of memory, and even from memory, it wasn't something that I paid attention to. You know, it was just something, it's a story you hear at security conferences, basically. So check that out if you're interested in the history of it. It is a fascinating history, though. I should look it up myself and really get all the details. There's probably a book about it. But PGP was pretty popular, and GNU-PG is the open source, or rather the free software implementation of PGP. Basically, what we could say is that GNU-PG, and I'm not going to talk about PGP anymore. That was the intro to PGP. Now forget it. We're dealing with GPG. So GNU Privacy Guard, you can kind of think of it, in a way, as an SSH key, except for a person. If you'll recall, or an SSL cert, except for a person. So it's kind of similar ideas, more or less. And the idea is that you have a lock, and you assign that to your identity. That is your lock. It's got your name on it. That's you. And then you distribute a bunch of keys out into the world. And those keys aren't any good to anybody, because they're just keys. A key without a lock is not very useful, but that's a key. Now, when they go to you and they want to ensure that they have the right person, they can use their key in that lock that you have. And if the key unlocks that lock, then they can have confidence that that lock and that key are intended to be a match. And I say it in that way because with identity, that's kind of a... that's kind of a big topic, and you can't say, oh, if your key matches this lock, then you are definitely who you claim to be, because you're not definitely who you claim to be. I guess probably like how do you confirm someone's real identity, like DNA testing or something? Like, however people who know about science and biology and stuff, like, then you can say, okay, well, yep. Yeah, you are this entity. Just because you have a lock that happens to fit a key doesn't really mean that you're necessarily definitely the same person, right? So there is that whole aspect of it. And it's definitely one of those things where you have to decide sort of, well, you get to determine what's actually important to you. Like how important is it to you that this person, like, is the person that they say they are, versus whether this person is the same person that you had been communicating with a week ago. And over the internet, that is often the important thing. And I guess a really good analogy would be if I, Klaatu, said, my name is Klaatu, and I am sending you, dear listener, a message. So I'll send you a key along with this message. And the message is that I want you to bring me a USB thumb drive. I won't be around, but I want you to put it in the treasure chest with the lock that your key will open. So you go to the place where I tell you the treasure chests are stored, and there are three different treasure chests there. You try the lock in each one, and on the third one, your key opens that lock. So that treasure chest, now you can assume, is the treasure chest to which someone calling themselves Klaatu has directed you. So you put your thumb drive into that treasure chest, you close it back up, you lock it back up, and you leave. Now, whether Klaatu comes later in the day to check on that treasure chest and to use Klaatu's key to open it up and retrieve your USB drive, or whether somebody else entirely claiming to be Klaatu all along owns that treasure chest, you'll never really know. All you can really be sure of is that someone claiming to be Klaatu sent you a key that happens to open this lock, and so you have to believe that that treasure chest and that lock belong to some entity calling itself Klaatu, if that makes any sense. It's the same thing with email, right? I mean, like, if you send me an email, then I will claim to be Klaatu in my response to you. And if we trade GNU PG information, then the person who you're sending email to is the same person who sent you the GNU PG information. But I mean, is that really the person you have in your mind's eye? The person you're picturing is Klaatu? Or is it one of Klaatu's staff members pretending to be Klaatu, all in his elaborate marketing campaign, which definitely does not exist, by the way. But now that I've said definitely, it sounds like I'm being sarcastic. It really doesn't exist. Klaatu, I'm the only Klaatu. Well, I'm not the only Klaatu. I'm someone claiming to be named Klaatu, and I'm on the internet. That's it. So that's GNU PG, sort of in theory. In practice, what this means is that you have to create what's known as a keychain on your computer. And the way that you do this is that you use the GPG2 command. Now, on other systems, they don't call the command GPG2. It'll be like GNU PG2 or something like that. And then there's, to make it even a little bit more confusing, there's different front ends as well. There's also a really, actually my preferred one is GPGMe. And that's a really good front end to the same system. So GPG2, or GNU PG2, but GPG2 on Slackware is the command. It is located in user bin GPG2. And to start your journey with GNU PG2, you do GPG2 space dash dash full dash generate dash key. And that's going to generate your GPG key. My analogy of the of one lock and many keys, that's not the terminology GPG uses, or SSH or SSL for that matter, probably with good reason, or maybe not. Maybe my analogy is great and people need to adopt it, I'm not sure. But GPG2 dash dash full dash generate dash key, that starts you down an interactive process of where you can create this GNU PG key that you own and that you will sort of be identified by. It gives me 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different options here, 1 through 4, with the first one being labeled as the default. That's RSA and RSA. The 14 is existing key from a card. I don't have key cards or anything like that, so I'm just going to select one. And now it says that an RSA key can be from 1024 and 4096 bits long. What key size do you want? Well, I think on, you know, really, really slow computers, people do try to sort of conserve how many bytes or bits rather they want their keys. But I mean, I'm not on a very slow computer, so I'm just going to go for 4096. And then it's asking me, when should this key expire? In some industries, I guess, it behooves people to set an expiry date for their key and then to update it and so on. I've never met anyone who does that or needs that. I mean, I'm not saying that's not something that happens. I'm just saying I have never been in an organization where that's been required. I mean, I've never been in an organization where GNU PG is required. So I don't know what this is for. I'm going to set this to 0. It's not going to expire. Is this correct? Y for yes. GNU PG needs to construct a user ID to identify your key. So I'm going to just put in, for my real name here, bogus, bogus. My email address is going to be bogus@example.com. And a comment, this is not really me. That looks good, so it gives me a chance to change the name, the comment, the email, or just to say okay, or to quit. So I'll say okay for that. Now it wants a password. Now this is something to consider. I mean, you probably want a password. That's kind of the two-factorness of this in a way. I mean, you two-factor is supposed to be something you know, something you have. In GNU PG2, the thing that you have is the key, therefore you should protect, you should bolster the requirements by also putting a password on this thing, which I will do. For the bogus user, I use bogus123 as the password, and it's telling me that I need to generate some entropy, and it tells me to do things like type on your keyboard or move the mouse or whatever to help with prime generation, and it gives a random number generator a better chance to gain enough entropy. That sounds really fun, except my computer is fast enough that it didn't even hesitate for that to happen. It just did the thing. So I don't know if that's good or bad, but it's already finished by the time I even reach for the mouse. So that's the first step. I have created a key for myself. That is my key, and it is my secret key specifically. Now if I go back to GBT2 space dash dash list dash secret keys, I see that, yep, I have a secret key here for bogus bogus. Oh, I have two secret keys, actually. I've done this before back in 2022, apparently. This is on a virtual machine, so it's who knows what state this thing is in. So that confirms that you have a personal key. Now, this is meant to be your key, sort of. Well, I mean, if you put in for it to never expire, then forever. Like, this is it. This is your identity now. If you start to distribute information, you know, the keys to this lock that you have, or the public keys that match with your secret key, then you change your secret key, then that could create a lot of confusion. So this is a really kind of frighteningly permanent thing. I mean, it's not permanent. You can revoke a key. And I've had to do that before, or I have voluntarily done that before, and it's been fine. But to be honest, I mean, I don't have that many people emailing me through GNU PG. Like, I do have several people who do, but a lot of people do not. So whether or not, like, would that scale? Like, if I had to revoke a key, how much confusion would it take? What would it create if I had a lot of people communicating with me through, you know, by encrypting their messages with GNU PG? I don't know. Probably not that much. I feel like the system is relatively robust. It can get confusing, and I will say that about GNU PG. I don't find it difficult, but I do admit that it can be a little overwhelming to try to sort of keep all the terminology and the reporting and the fingerprints and all these, you know, you got secret keys and you got a keychain and you got other keys of other people and all these other things. And it just seems like all the terms are being used for lots of different things. It gets overwhelming if you try to think about it too hard. And I actually find that it's easier if you don't really overthink it. Like, a lot of this stuff just kind of works if you're using open source software. I will admit that if you start using other systems in here, it does start to fall apart, because a lot of closed systems don't bother with privacy tools at all, and they just doesn't occur to them that anyone might want to protect, you know, their privacy or identity. So that can get more complex. But on an open system, a lot of this just kind of works. So you got a GNU PG key. Now what? Well, the first thing that you're really meant to do is advertise that you have this key, and that it seems weird that you're gonna tell everyone about this key. Well, you're not giving them your secret key, first of all. It's actually not super easy to do that anyway. So I think it would be difficult for you to accidentally do that. But what you do need is to submit your key to what's called a key server. And you can think of a key server kind of like a DNS server in a weird way, by which all I mean is that, like, it's a bunch of servers out there on the internet that track public keys to email addresses or to identities, I guess. But yeah, to email addresses as well, because usually, like for GNU PG, the end result, or, you know, the use case of it is generally, oh, I'm sending you an email. I want to make sure you're the person who is actually who has the email address that I'm sending this to. So I'll encrypt it with code compatible with your secret key. So to do that, you can do a GPG. To dash dash send key or keys send. Boy, there's really not, it's not telling me anything about whether that's Send keys or key. Okay, send keys, plural. Wow, that's so interesting that it doesn't error out. It just silently fails. That's unusual. So, okay, so I'm going to do gpg2--list-keys and grab this really, really long number associated with my new key. I think that's called the fingerprint, or maybe the fingerprint is just like the first 8 characters or something. I forget. But it's a big long string of numbers, hexadecimal numbers. So you'll see E's and C's and D's and A's and things like that in there. And I'll copy that to my clipboard, and then I'll do gpg2--send-keys, and then I'll paste that number in, and then I'm going to do keyserver equals fake.example.com, because I don't actually want to send a key. But if I did want to send a key, I would. That's too bad. It just sent that key to Ubuntu's key server for some bizarre reason. Keyserver.ubuntu.com just got the bogus at example.com gpg2 key. Apparently key-keyserver equals fake.example.com is not, that does, it doesn't see that as a key server, and so it just defaults to the next, to a valid one. That is unexpected. And I guess I should have set -e prior to doing that. It still works. I don't know how to get this thing not to send a key, but it just did send the key. Anyway, don't do that. Send an actual valid key to a key server. And then people who get emails from you and want to encrypt messages for you can look up your email address with GPG2 on their computer. In fact, I could do search keys bogus@example.com, I guess. And this application, this little command, GPG2, pings, in this case, pgp.surf.nl, and asks for bogus@example.com. And there are comfortingly several of them on here. So any of these, none of these look familiar to me. Yeah, none of these are mine, the ones that I just sent. But there are 6 on pgp.surf.nl. Now, the reason I'm not seeing mine yet is because, I could probably find it if I specified the key server to keyserver.ubuntu.com, because I know that's the key server that it got sent to. I don't know how much of a delay there is. But this is kind of a mesh network like DNS. So, it does take a wee while for your GPG key to propagate from one server to the next server all around the world. So it might not show up instantly. However, something showed up, and it is apparently for bogus at something named bogus@example.com. And so I could import one of these keys and then send an email to bogus.example.com, and that would not work, of course, because that's a fake email address. But you could do that if it was a real person with a real email address. And now you've got the half of the code that you need to encrypt your message, and then they'll have their secret key on the other end that matches this public key. The two fit together, and suddenly the thing can be decrypted. Now I'm going to cancel out of this. You can do this sort of thing with, you can do this sort of thing manually. Like, you can encrypt something just by yourself. Like, I'll do echo, quote, hello world, and then I'll pipe that through gpg2--. Symmetric. I don't know how to spell symmetric. And then it's prompting me for my passphrase, which is, of course, bogus123. And now I have to repeat it, bogus123. So I'll say okay to that. And it spits out the encrypted text that I've just created. Symmetric encryption just means that it's encrypting it based on, you know, on two halves of the same key, basically. So I'm encrypting it for myself, which wouldn't necessarily make sense. But you could also encrypt it for a specific user. You can launch gpg2--encrypt, and then specify the user ID of the person you want to encrypt something with, or for, rather. So let's do clatu@gnuworldblah.info. And then I'm on a blank line, and I can, it's, it, that gives me an error because it knows that it doesn't have any user called that. But you can just type in messages there at the prompt and encrypt it. You can encrypt files, you can encrypt whatever you want for specific users. And as long as you have that user's key in your keychain, then you can encrypt it just so that they can open it with their secret key. So you've got a secret key of your own. Other people on the internet have keys of their own. To encrypt something for someone else, you need their public key. So for someone to send you an encrypted message, they have to have your public key. You sent your public key to a key server with GPG2 --send-keys, whatever it was it plural? Well, it worked as a plural, so I'll assume that's what it is. Plural, so GPG2--send-keys, and then your secret key fingerprint. That's not sending your secret key up to the key server. That is sending the public part of your key up to a key server. Okay, so that means anyone can get your public key now, which means that anyone can send an email to you encrypted for your identity. The way to make that really easy is to use open source. For instance, in KMail, you can set up your own, you can set up your GPG key for each identity in the tab called cryptography. So if you're not super familiar with KMail, you go up to settings, configure KMail, and then you go down to No, you don't go down anywhere. There's the accounts tab over on the left. So you click that, that's what comes up as default anyway. And you've got a list of identities, maybe. Maybe you just have one identity. I have several. Klaatu default, and then a bunch of work addresses, and then a bunch of gaming addresses, and all the different identities that I sort of divide up amongst various email addresses. So I'll double click on Klaatu. It comes up with a new window, edit identity Klaatu. And there's the general tab where you've got your name and your email address and email aliases and so on. And then cryptography, open PGP signing key. And you can just choose from your, it has an awareness of your keychain, and you can choose which key you want to use in that drop-down menu. Once you have your keys defined, if someone sends you a GPG, a GNU PG encrypted email, KMail knows what key you have available to you, and it'll decrypt those messages. At least on mine, and I can't remember if this is something that I have set specially, or if this is the default, or even if it can be overridden, I don't know. It comes in encrypted, and there's a message at the top of the message window that says, like, this is encrypted, click to decrypt, or something like that, and I click it, and then it decrypts it. I don't remember if I have to do that every time I look at the message, or if that's just, like, the initial decryption. I feel like that's just the initial decryption. I could be wrong, though. When you email someone, so if someone's emailed you an encrypted message, then when you reply to them, I believe KMail just kind of automatically figures, oh yeah, you're doing the GNU PG thing, I'll have encryption turned on for this message. I, again, could be wrong, that might be a setting somewhere that I have set up, but in my experience, it tends to be the case. I also believe that I have KMail, no, I remember that I have KMail set to send my key. Do I though? I don't remember. Maybe I don't. It's funny what you don't really think about, and then once you try to pin it down. I used to have KMail send a copy of my public key, like, with every email, but people would get really, really confused. Like, I guess maybe Gmail was, like, trying to make it something that it wasn't, and it would really confuse people, and just so many times people would email me back and just tell me that they couldn't open up the .asc file or whatever, and didn't know what to do with it, and what was it, and all this other stuff, so I just stopped doing that. But you can digitally sign your messages, you can encrypt your messages, and those are two separate things. And in practice, as I have found, really, the encryption is the only one that has any, I guess, any importance. I mean, any real effect. You can digitally sign it, that's great, big deal. Like, it has a little signature, not a literal signature. It's got an encoded thing that says, yep, this was sent from this secret key, or, from someone with access to this secret key, essentially. I've never seen that do anything. I don't know of any system that necessarily even acknowledges that. I could be wrong. And again, I it's hard sometimes for me to tell how much of Kmail is just Kmail being very clever, and how much of it is, I don't know, like GNU PG doing something really cool and Kmail having no real part in it. I'm not sure where one ends and one where one begins and where one ends. So it's a really, really, really seamless experience in Kmail. I highly recommend it. I believe last I checked, Thunderbird had integrated the, I think it used to be called Lightning. Was it Lightning or something like that? I don't know. There was a plugin that did GNU PG with Thunderbird, but Thunderbird, now that it's kind of been rebooted, relaunched, revived, whatever, I believe they've just integrated that plugin into the main interface. But having said that, I have not tried it myself for any extended amount of time. So, and I've not experienced it at all since it's been integrated. Back when I was using Thunderbird, I did use that plugin when it was still a plugin, and it worked great. It was fine. The nice thing about Kmail is that it does, and probably Thunderbird as well, but they tend to pick up on the idea that yes, you are in a GNU PG thread. So we will assume that you want to continue to send encrypted messages back and forth. And it doesn't like deactivate it, exposing all of the information in the thread that you've been meaning to encrypt the whole time. It doesn't do that. It defaults to being encrypted. Unless you never told it to encrypt something and you don't have that person's key anyway, you know, then you don't even have to worry about it. It just won't, it's not going to encrypt something for someone that doesn't exist because it doesn't have their public key, so it can't. So it's pretty darned easy to use, and it just kind of fades into the background, honestly. Like, really fades into the background. I've had great experience with it. Couldn't recommend it more. No idea why we're not using it every day. It is one of those things that I just cannot understand why that wouldn't be the default, except that most people read their email on someone else's server anyway, and it's going to be decrypted on that box, and it just doesn't, it wouldn't make sense for so many people. That said, it could be coded so that it didn't do it that way. There is technology that we have that could deliver a decrypted view of an encrypted file without it actually sort of being stored on that server. So I feel like GNU PG is definitely one of those things that needs a let's encrypt kind of campaign where just everyone finally starts to encrypt their email. But it would take a huge, I mean, what Let's Encrypt did for OpenSSL is just kind of, I don't know, like if you'd asked me if it was possible, I'd have said no, it'll never happen. So I don't know how Let's Encrypt managed to do it. It's one of the, to my mind, one of the more successful campaigns on the internet. You know, I mean, think of how long we've been trying to get IPv6 to be a thing. There have been campaigns. I've got stickers of IPv6 on this computer, and it still isn't really a thing. Whereas OpenSSL, just somehow with Let's Encrypt, just it actually is just it is truly everywhere. And I don't know how to get GNU PG everywhere. But on open source, you have a bunch of great tools to make it possible. And just to reiterate sort of the process here, GPG2 space dash dash generate dash full dash key, go through that, and then GPG2 dash dash send dash keys, no, sorry, list dash keys, get the fingerprint of your key. It's a big long number that goes on forever. Copy that, and then GPG2 dash dash send dash keys, paste in that fingerprint number, hit return. Now your public key is out there in the world. You've got your private key on your system. Go over to your email client, whether it's Kmail or Thunderbird or Evolution or Claws or Canine or one of those two. Silfeed, I don't know if that's even around anymore. Whatever open source email client you got, I can definitely vouch for Kmail and Thunderbird. Go there, configure your account in Kmail. It's under settings, configure Kmail, and then you click on your identity, you double click on your identity, go to the cryptography tab, select your secret key, and now you're set. You are set to go. There's a button when you're making a new, when you're doing a new message. There is a button at the top that says that you can encrypt, you know, the message. So if you've got the user's email, if you've got the user's public key when you're sending them an email, really Kmail will probably auto-detect that you have that. If not, just click that button, encrypt, and then you're encrypting your email for them, and they can do the same back at you, and it just goes on like that. Super easy. Try it. Try it the next time you email me. Or not. I mean, no pressure. You can email me unencrypted. But if you're thinking about it, give it a go. Although I will say, once again, it is a bit of a commitment. It is the intent that when you generate that key, that is your key. That's your secret key. Now you can revoke it, but again, this is all a commitment, right? Now you have a key that you have now, and you have to keep track of it. So you should be backing up your home directory or export your key with a --export-secret-key to a file so that if anything happens to your computer, you still have your secret key. The way you do that is gpg2--export-secret-key, and then the fingerprint, I think. I better do this. I thought I could just do it off the top of my head, but I can't. gpg2--export-secret-key. Do I still have this in my clipboard? No, I don't. There we go. That key, and then redirect to mykey.as, what is it, ASC or something? Maybe I also need --armor. And it's asking me for my password, bogus123, and there we go. Yeah, so gpg2--armor, A-R-M-O-U-R, --export-secret-key, and then the fingerprint of your secret key, which again, you can always get that by using gpg2--list-secret-keys, and then you redirect that to some file. And for whatever reason, it's frequently my, or like, you know, whatever you want to call it, but it's .asc, and I don't know what the .asc stands for. You could also just, I think you can, yeah, do ASC. So anyway, if you get a new computer then, or whatever, get an additional computer and you want to use that secret key there, you can do it gpg2--import. mykey.asc, and it imports that key back into your key chain. So you need to keep track of it is the bottom line. And if you don't, people should ask you why you can no longer read their email. Because that's the red flag this is supposed to raise. You're supposed to have your secret key. If all of a sudden you are not able to read the email that your friends are sending you in an encrypted format, that means you don't have your secret key. Why would that be? How do we know you are who you say you are from over the internet? That secret key was your guarantee. And if you don't have that, that seems awfully suspicious. People should be asking questions. People should stop communicating sensitive information with you because you suddenly have lost your key, and you should have to regain trust after that. That's how the system is designed. So if you create a key, keep track of it. That's GNU PG and GNU PG2. It's a great application. Really, really nice. It does some amazing things. Like I say, you can do this for local files as well. The password store, the Linux pass utility, that uses GPG for when you're editing password files, or rather for when you store the password files, and it uses GPG dynamically when you're editing them. It's really, really nice. There's just a lot you can do with GNU PG for quick and convenient encryption. And I find that one of the best ways to sort of get comfortable with it is, again, don't overthink it. Don't overthink the terminology. Just kind of get used to having a secret key versus a key. Get used to the fact that it's all stored in a keychain, whatever that is. Who cares? Doesn't matter. It's on your system. And it'll just kind of work. It'll work with a lot of different things that need encryption, and it's a really, really nice system. Use it to get used to it, and you'll get comfortable with it. I use it for local files, like if I'm you know, certainly all my passwords that I do use with the pass command, those are all GPG files, and they're just right there in my home directory. So it's a great little application. Try it out if you're at all interested in keeping your data encrypted. That's it. That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. I will talk to you next time.